Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for July 18th, 2019, and tonight, a little diversion from my normal talking head, James McCanny. I have a guest tonight. His name is Mark Gaffney. I met him many years ago. We'll talk about that. But Mark has been working on a project which I've delved into from another aspect over the past years, but a long time ago, some scholars came to the belief that because of physical evidence, etc., that the Earth had had a pole shift. And this is a physical pole shift, and then related with that may have been a magnetic pole shift, which are two very distinct issues. And so anyway, Mark has picked up the torch on this and has traveled. He's done a lot of work putting together research into the getting us up to the point we are today. But the main crux of what we're going to discuss here is what is the basic knowledge at this point of a pole shift. And now I want to clarify too that this became a talking point. But anyway, I'm going to try and talk as little as possible and have Mark talk as much as possible in this show, and this will be our first of many interviews. So this is an introduction to the topic. And with that, Mark, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Jim. Very happy to be with you. This is going to be a lot of fun. I tell you, and I mentioned before we started, that this is really exciting. This project has got me so fired up. I'm having the time of my life with this book project.
Right, and this is another thing. Right now on my webpage at the very top, jmccsci.com, there's a link to a paper that Mark has written, which is basically an introduction. It's just a get-your-feet-wet type of paper, but he's working on an extensive book on this topic, so that will be coming out in the future. But we wanted to get this topic out in the public domain because, as it turns out, there's other people that are doing different types of studies along this same line. But Mark, he asked me, he said, can we get this out so I can get priority on the dating of his work? And I said, yeah. So it's on my webpage. There's the link. You can read the article with the caveat that there's a lot more coming on this. There's a lot more research going on. But Mark, explain a little bit about the history of this topic, of the pole shift issue, and Hapgood and some of the other researchers, and then explain how you got into this and where you're going today.
Let's make it clear to the listeners we're talking about when we say pole shift, we mean the crustal displacement. So the whole crust of the Earth moved, and it's really a shocking thought. I mean, this is a very radical idea. And mainstream science today looks askance at it. They look upon Hapgood, Charles Hapgood, as a pseudoscientist or a crank. But in fact, he was anything but. He was a very careful researcher. And when I first heard about the I got onto this when I first heard about the displacement of the pyramids down near Mexico City. That Avenue of the Dead is 15.5 degrees east of north. And when given that the pyramids of Giza are, and many other pyramids on Earth are lined up to the North Pole, you know, they're aligned to the North Pole, the true North Pole, what's going on here? So this is what caught my attention originally and got me onto this. But, you know, it's a long process.
Mark, just clarify when you said the Avenue of the Dead, was that what you mentioned? But explain where that was.
This is the Pyramid of the Sun and the Moon, 20-some miles from Mexico City, just north of Mexico City. This is probably the oldest site in Mexico.
So what we typically call Teotihuacan, is that correct?
That's correct, Teotihuacan.
Right. So the big pyramids, the tourist attraction, they're massive pyramids, but they are displaced not to the north and the east cardinal coordinates as we would expect, something that is that dramatic, that much attuned to the stars in astronomy, and it's, you know, an odd number of degrees off. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all until you realize that something happened to cause that.
Yes, and, you know, my interest got deepened as I learned more. For example, in 1974, there was an aerial survey of central Mexico. There were some flyovers. And the report out of that was that it isn't just these ceremonial sites that are displaced. Towns, villages, and even agricultural fields in that region are east of north. They're all aligned east of north, so the question is why?
Right, right, exactly. Also mention, we talked about Hapgood. When did he come into the picture? What was his time frame?
Well, Hapgood, I believe he was in military intelligence during World War II. I think he was in the OSS. But he had connections with naval intelligence, and I think they actually helped him with some of his research. But he approached Albert Einstein back in the last couple years of Einstein's life with his theory about crustal displacement, and he did a book on it back in the 1950s called Earth's Shifting Crust that laid out the first theory, you know, and Einstein really supported it. He thought that Hapgood was onto something really important. But then Hapgood had to back away from his initial conclusion. He had a hypothesis that that was the ice caps, the South Pole ice cap that had actually caused the crustal displacement, but it wasn't near enough. There was not near enough mass down there to do it. So finally, he had to back away from that. He never did explain a mechanism. He never produced a mechanism for it.
That is the key. So he noticed data, geographical, geological, and other types of physical data of the Earth, and said, hey, you know, things have moved. And by the way, that's what you've done, Mark. You've picked up this torch and have advanced it greatly based on a lot of modern information. But he lacked the mechanism. I just want to mention, too, that Velikovsky was a good friend of Einstein's. They were both at Princeton. They were good friends. I interviewed Warner Sizemore, and he's a good friend of mine going way back, and my listeners know the history of that. But Warner Sizemore was Velikovsky's personal secretary, and he was at Velikovsky's house at Princeton through the decades that Velikovsky was there. And anyway, Einstein would come over for supper and play the violin and talk with them. So they were good friends. But anyway, when Einstein died, he had Velikovsky's book, World in Collisions, open on his desk. And this was, of course, 1957, a few years after that came out. And one of the reasons Einstein was very interested in this, because Einstein was working on a more advanced form of general relativity in which you included the electric and magnetic fields, what he called the total field. And he never got to the point, but he was interested in Velikovsky's proposals that there was electrical activity in the solar system, and it was accounted for by ancient peoples from all over the world. But it's interesting that Hapgood also approached Einstein and got a favorable response.
Yes, and then Hapgood continued his research over the years, subsequent years. He did an amazing book called The Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, where he explored the evidence that ancient mariners had really advanced knowledge of the South, Antarctic continent, and even the coastline had mapped it accurately. And I want to mention this because I was just reading through a book about, the title is, I can give you the title, The Quaternary Ice Age by W.B. Wright. And there are some maps in here of Antarctica showing that even in the early 20th century, our maps were really terrible of the Antarctic continent. So this is we've really gotten up to speed on Antarctica just in recent decades. It's just been the last 30, 40 years.
Right. And the other thing about Antarctica is where the Columbus had the Perry Rees map, which showed the outline of the Antarctica coastline. But of course, Columbus didn't know that. And that's what he was looking for en route to India. And so what he didn't realize was that at the time, Antarctica was in a temperate location, and only after satellite imagery and radar did they actually map the actual coastline of Antarctica, South America, or I mean Antarctica, the South Polar land mass, and it matched exactly the Perry Rees map. And the Perry Rees map was an old Phoenician sailing map that was passed down, and Columbus got his hands on. So he was looking for that, but of course never found it. But it's interesting that Hapgood also did research, and it's also interesting that Hapgood was associated with military intelligence. And of course, in World War II, there was a great deal of activity around the South Pole.
That's right. And Admiral Byrd, a couple of expeditions down there, and one in the late 40s. And there was a book that came out of that expedition by Thomas Henry, which I've been reading, called The White Continent, which had the imprimatur of Byrd on it. Byrd loved this manuscript, and it's really excellent, kind of a basic knowledge about Antarctica, telling the history. And what I've learned is that there's no way these ancient mariners could have approached Antarctica today, because there's the conditions down there are just so terrible in the ocean, the winds, you've got these giant bergs, icebergs, the currents are horrendous down there, and the weather is terrible. There's no way they could have approached the edge of that continent where it is today, only if it had been that one coast, the West Antarctic coast, had been a lot further north. That's right. The only way they could have approached it.
Right, right. When I made my estimates of where the old North Pole was, and this is in my writing and my work, et cetera, and my goal was not to actually locate the old North Pole, but just to talk about the process of how it happens. But it turns out that what you have found is much, it isn't as a large a pole shift. I was talking about 35 degrees. But in any case, that would put Antarctica, in either case, it would put Antarctica up into a semi-temperate location, and that would have been a main traveled route of mariners back in those days. And the other thing that I want to mention in my book, Atlantis to Tesla, I actually quote a Brazilian physicist who located the old Atlantean continent in the South China Sea. And the Pillars of Hercules to enter were Krakatoa, modern Krakatoa, and the sister volcano, which is no longer there because it blew up, it completely blew up in subsequent eruptions. But there were two major volcanoes at the Strait of Sunda between Java and Sumatra, and that was the entrance into the old continent of Atlantis. But that's why they were going back and forth, and the Phoenicians were traders back in those early days. So this all fits together. But they had the map of that coastline, which now is covered with ice.
Yes, and the area that you're talking about over in the South China Sea, well, south of there, actually, but in the same region, there was actually a subcontinent there during the last glacial maximum. That most of that area there was above the sea level, and because of the change that happened at the end of the ice age, not only with the melting of the ice, but I think there was a major case of subsidence there. That whole region went below the ocean. So if there was Atlantis was there, it is under the water right now.
Right. Looking at the North Pole, and this is something that if you look on, I found this interesting, National Geographic once did a special on the Laurentian ice cap, which is basically the old North Pole and a lot of glaciation that went with it. But it covered much of North America down into Iowa. It extended up to where Greenland is now, and that's one of the interesting things. Greenland is one of the places that was in the old North Pole cap and the new one. So that's why it keeps layering up, and so people that do the study of the Greenland ice cores don't find any discontinuation. They find it to be continuous. But then at the same time, Siberia with the mastodons was a semi-tropical, not tropical, but temperate location where you had herds of millions of mastodons. And the interesting thing about the mastodons is that they were tremendous eaters. I mean, these things are five times the size of an elephant. And to have herds of millions of them, you need tremendous amount of growth. So the Earth, the point is that the Earth actually had a different atmosphere at that time. So some really, really major issues happened when the dinosaurs, or not when the mastodons went under at the end of the Holocene period, and the saber-toothed tiger and all those big animals all over the world went under. And if you look up mass extinctions on Google or Wikipedia, they don't talk about the mastodon mass extinction, not at all. And so that's, I find that very interesting. But what we're talking about here is a pole shift, a physical, and you have a different term for it, which I like. I like that, the idea that did you call it a crustal shift?
Crustal displacement. I just borrowed that phrase from Hapgood.
I like that because the idea of pole shift has been so misused and abused. It's like one of those terms that should be a good term, but it's not because it's been so misused and abused by disinformation programs. But were there other people besides Hapgood that were in this realm, pole shift, etc.?
There were a couple of others, Jim, but not any. No one did the amount of research that Hapgood did. He really did just a tremendous amount of research, two books on the subject. And his second book, The Path of the Pole, is extremely well put together. He backed off of the trying to propose a mechanism. He realized he didn't know what caused it, but the evidence was nonetheless very strong that the event had happened. It was tremendous research that he did in that second book. And before we move on, I want to just make another comment about the mammoths. You mentioned how they were so large and had a huge amount of, required a huge amount of food. Well, you're not going to get that kind of food production to support those millions of mammoths if Siberia was a tundra at that time. It had to be further south, where you had the luxuriant grasslands. And my placement of the pole position, the former pole on Baffin Island, we can do measurements now with Google Earth Pro, and I've done some of these, and this would place the new Siberian islands, the far north of Siberia today, would place them at the latitude of Denmark, and mid Siberia, Yakutsk would be all the way down around the latitude of Naples, Italy. So it would be way far south, so you'd have very mild conditions there that could support a huge grassland and a large, very large mammoth population and a lot of other megafauna too.
Right. And one of the things is that it may have had a much richer carbon dioxide atmosphere in which the growth would be, like if you take and double or triple the carbon dioxide of a greenhouse, people do that and they get this amazing growth. So with an atmosphere, a different atmosphere than what we have today, you could have that kind of growth, and there would be ways of measuring those types of things. But what we're looking at here is first of all, we have to stop using this astronomical top-down model that the solar systems began 4.5 billion years ago, and nothing has happened since except a couple little asteroid collisions. You know, we got to get away from that idea that's been pounded down everybody's throat.
Absolutely. We live in a dynamic universe, and Things have been changing continually. In fact, the only constant in our universe is change. Even it may sometimes it takes place very slowly. Other times, it's very fast, and even we have catastrophic changes. So these two types of change coexist. They both happen.
Exactly. Yeah. The one thing too about the mastodons, I found this interesting. Was it Discover magazine? I forget which magazine. It'll come to mind in a minute. Had a picture, and they were digging a mastodon up out of the tundra up in Siberia, and they had to bring in a great big, like, Chinook helicopter from the U.S. because it was the only helicopter that could pick up that kind of a load. But they carved out all around this mastodon, and he's standing on all 4 feet, frozen to death in the tundra, had not fallen over, and with semi-tropical or temperate climate flowers in the throat. That's how fast they were flash frozen, basically, in the tundra that is there now. And when the Trans-Siberian Railway was cut through through Siberia, the workers found mastodons and they ate the meat. Now, this is many, many thousands of years old. And I guarantee you, roadkill, or if they would have been there one day in a warm climate, they would have already began to decompose to the point it would not have. So they were flash frozen, instantly frozen. This is an animal five times the size of an elephant, millions of them, standing on all fours.
Well, this brings up the question, Jim, and I've been discussing it also with Dr. Bill Deagle. Just how fast did this crustal displacement take place? Hapgood, if you read his book, he was arguing that it must have happened over 1,000 years, but then later he kind of backed off of that, and he never really reached a firm opinion about it later on in his research. But Dr. Deagle thinks it happened over a period of weeks and maybe a couple of months. What do you think? Do you have an idea about that? It's got to be fast. It's got to be relatively fast to deep freeze all these mammoths. But just how fast? What do you think?
Okay, it happened in less than 24 hours. And the reason I say that is because the mechanism is a large astronomical body that comes by Earth and sets up a gravitational wave in Earth. It's called a tidal wave. It's the same thing that happens with our oceans. As the Earth spins underneath the moon, the Earth bulges out about 12 to 15 feet at the maximum, the oceans. But the Earth crust itself bulges about an inch, and that's one of the causes of this constant jostling of the Earth that can affect earthquakes, etc., and tectonic boundaries and potentially volcanoes, this constant working of the Earth. But if you take something big, there's many factors physically, and this is what I've worked on, is the physics of this, is that if the object is coming much faster, the wave has much more of an impulse. And that's what causes the matter in the crust and the mantle to shift, whereas the core continues to spin at the same rate. So the rate of rotation of the Earth doesn't change that much. It's just that the top layers of the Earth, it's kind of like the shell of an egg. It slides over the inside continues to spin. And all of this I explain in my Surviving Planet X Passage book. I have diagrams and et cetera. But this happened in a matter of 24 hours. This thing came by, whoosh, it was, mountain building. The Mayans talk about Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, whose heart became the planet Venus, which was referring to the Venus comet. That happened in overnight. It was boom. It was
well, Jim. Let me just ask you, because this brings to mind another question, another mystery that Darwin actually noticed. And other people have also documented that the Andes mountain range was lifted up at least 2,000 feet It appears to have happened very quickly. And the meridian of maximum displacement that follows from identifying the pole position on Baffin Island, that we are able, because of that, because we now know the placement of that pole, the meridian of maximum displacement is a great circle around the Earth, and it just happens to parallel the Andes mountain range north to south. And there's other implications also, but that we can talk about another time. But do you think that this gravity wave followed that meridian of maximum displacement? And do you think that this is when the Andes rose up 2,000 feet?
Well, let's go back a little bit. There have been many of these, and I've studied mountains. Let's take the southern Colorado Rockies that you go down into, down as far as New Mexico, for example. You can see 20 different episodes of mountain building down there where the mountains come in from different angles, etc. And what happens is the wave is in the ground. It's literally like a wave coming in off the ocean. And when it hits that existing mountain range, the mountain range absorbs the energy. And that's where the energy comes from for mountain building, for raising plates and all of this. The idea that somehow this plate raised those mountains up, 20, 30,000 feet into the air and all of that mass by simply pushing from the sides is ridiculous. The physics, it doesn't support it. I mean, one of my criticisms of geologists and archaeoastronomers and other groups is that they probably didn't go very far in physics. And so they missed the point that what's the physical process. And actually, I'll be honest with you, the idea that Hapgood did not present a physical process was good. Because now, later, decades later, when we put a physical process to this, his information is very valuable. The biggest thing they criticized Velikovsky on, and the biggest mistake that Velikovsky made, was that he tried to propose a model. And in the 1950s, they didn't know about the solar wind. They didn't know what comets were. They didn't, what we know today was very much different. But Velikovsky, trying to be an honest guy, tried to make some proposals based on models of the 1950s, and it didn't work. So that's what they criticized him on. Sagan never talked about his calendar work, never talked about the mastodons and all the other geological evidence. They criticized him on the astronomy part, which he failed miserably. But
he was not an astronomer. He was a psychiatrist, right?
Yeah, exactly. He was studying calendars. He was trying to find a baseline of time that would connect ancient civilizations. And then when the criticism came, he tried to propose astronomical models. And what I'm saying is Hapgood didn't bite that hook, thank goodness. Both of them produced great material. The other thing is, the pole shift didn't just happen once. What we're dealing with here is just the most recent one. And we'll talk about dating and things like that, some estimates. But this is the most recent one dealing with the shifting of the old North Pole, which we call the old North Pole. And that was the demise of the mastodons, something that, like I say, if you look for mass extinctions, they don't touch it with a 10-foot pole because it's too recent.
Right, exactly. Well, I will be discussing the mammoths in my I'm going to have a separate chapter about Siberia. What I'm looking at is this meridian of maximum displacement, this great circle around the Earth, and I'm going to be studying different regions along that line. Antarctica is another one, in greater detail, because those are the regions that have the most profound evidence, if we look, for this crustal displacement. That's why this pole position is so important.
Exactly.
Now, I totally agree with you about that this has happened many times in the Earth's history, but and each one of these events has a signature that describes it. If you know where to look for the evidence, you're going to find it. If you know what to look for and where, you're going to find it. The problem is, each time this happens, a lot of the evidence for previous displacements gets erased, or, you know, it becomes harder to read it. It becomes more difficult to discern that signature.
Right, right. And that's one of the things, looking into the past, we have, it's like a deck of cards, you know, like, say, 20 cards, 20 mass extinctions, pull out a card, and what is it? You know, and imagine trying to put these in order, these 20 cards, without seeing the cards. That'd be this kind of the equivalent of, you know, if you took cards, you couldn't see their faces, what's the possibility of putting them all in order? Pretty low. And that's what we're faced with here. But the most recent one was a pretty good jarring event. And it appears that the object that came by was pretty close and moving pretty fast. And so, but I believe it's safe to say that every mass extinction was related to a celestial event. And I want to repeat, not a little asteroid colliding with Earth. That was heralded by NASA because they didn't have to talk about the real issue. Just looking at the so-called dinosaur demise, for example, lots of things happened when the dinosaurs went under, and that happened in a day. They try and talk about an object hitting the Yucatan Peninsula, and there's a crater there. But later studies showed that the dinosaurs right in that local area didn't even die off. There's dinosaur remains on top of the debris from that collision. So that's not what killed the dinosaurs, let alone dinosaurs all over the world. That was just a localized event. Basically, the energy was absorbed locally, and the dinosaurs very much lived after that. So, but something is going on where the atmosphere of the Earth was taken away, and the Earth went back to basically cellular life at a certain point.
So you think, Jim, let me just try to drill down on this one a little deeper. You think that a close passage by a planetary-sized comet swept a lot of the atmosphere, just sucked it right off the planet? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And in the case of the most recent one, we have historical records of people that were living at the time. And what happened was, here's the situation. Once the comet connects electrically with the Earth, or in the case of Mars lost its atmosphere and oceans recently. The ancients talk about that as it being a blue planet. If the surface gravity of the object passing by is greater, it's going to suck the atmosphere off the planet that it's coming by, as it did with Mars, as it potentially did with Earth in the past. If the Earth, for example, has a greater surface gravity, once they make that connection, then the Earth is going to win, and the Earth is going to gain basically a pollution event. So the ancients talk about the raining of naphtha, the brimstone and naphtha being hydrocarbons that burn as they come in, meet the oxygen in the atmosphere. A lot of the oil, that surface oil on the Earth, came in from the comet tail. And we know there are hydrocarbons in comet tails. We know there's water in comet tails. So the flooding, things like that. So each one of these events has different characteristics. The Noah's flood, it was basically passing through the tail of a water comet. And whereas the Venus event, which was the Moses event or the Quetzalcoatl event, happened within the last 5,000 years. And that was also the event that changed the pole and killed off the mastodons, almost drove the human population into extinction also.
Okay, so you have a different point of view on the timing. I haven't nailed that down, but I'm going to argue from what I know so far, from what I know at present, that the timing was at the end of the ice age, somewhere around 10 or 11,000 years ago, when this last pole shift happened.
Yeah, but there again, I don't put dates on things. I don't personally. The reason I'm using those dates is because the best guy at dating that I know is Velikovsky, and he put it at 1500 BC. But it could extend out as far as 10,000 BC. Here's the issue, is that we're just kind of breaking through on this. There have been some scholars that have done really great work, but they really didn't have the tools. Velikovsky, you know, died in the 1970s, 1976 or something. Einstein was in the 50s. I don't know how long Hapgood lived, but he wrote some books. But this topic has never been able to be approached by scholars in general who could dig into texts, dig into history, dig into things like you're doing, like reef beds, movement of mollusks, like you're doing.
Yes,
science has never allowed this to happen before. So what we're doing is we're breaking the law of science and bringing out the fact that yes, there was a pole shift. Yes, it happened, and it happened, you know, within the last 10,000 years. I'd say that's safe to say. Now we have to do more work, and there's probably ways of making estimates, like say reef building. Reef building can be measured in terms of, you know, age, etc. How long has this reef been there that wasn't there previously? You know, so there's things that we can look at. For example, you can date a ship that's in a reef by how much coral is on top of it. And the same thing. But what I'm saying is we're just starting to breach this topic. And it's very necessary. And like I say, we have to get away from this idea that the Earth just, that none of this ever happened, that these mass extinctions just, oh, was due to global warming or some complete hogwash, you know, that has no scientific validity at all.
That's right. And we're living in a time when scientists are actually seriously talking about how trees survived, you know, in the Arctic or at Antarctica in total darkness, which they believe was the reality a long time ago, like millions of years ago, because we know that there were forests in Antarctica. So how did they survive in total darkness during the polar winter? Because that they believe that the crust has been constant. Well, you know, that we're going to, I'm going to demolish that idea in my book. There's so many examples you can cite. I mean, and some of it's a bit comical. We really do have a flat Earth mentality here in the scientific community at present.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. Yeah, flat Earth mentality. And this happened, the person that solidified this was Carl Sagan, when in 1979 to 81, it happened to be the exact time I was at Cornell. Carl was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series, and this became the blueprint for all science. All science had to follow this. And all good scientists that work in a university or that work for the government or in scientific endeavors, whatever, have memorized these. It's like the nursery rhyme of science. And they all have to comply with it. Otherwise, they know that their funding will be cut, their tenure will be lost, whatever. So at any rate, yeah, we're living in the dark ages of science, kind of. And this is by mandate. It's science by mantra, I call it, that everybody repeats it like a Buddhist mantra. And if everybody repeats it, then everybody's happy.
It's interesting to me that the more things change, the more they stay the same. When you look back at the 19th century, the first half of the 19th century, and you had these brilliant men like Darwin and Lyell, and there were others too, plenty of others, and they were shaking themselves off from the grip of the church and, you know, the Inquisition, and they were just getting free of that. And now we're back into a similar, we have a similar situation, but it isn't the church anymore. It's this what do you call it, Jim? The scientific elite, or how do you describe this?
Well, it's the scientific religion. It's the dogma of the day. And like I say, this was solidified by Carl Sagan in the Cosmos series. And this outlined all of the different things that happened in the solar system, in the universe, the Big Bang idea. You know, everything that happened, everything has to follow that mantra. And if it doesn't, you know, scientists know, don't even go there. And so that's why I was mentioning, for example, the archaeology or the archaeoastronomy department at Cornell when I was there. They were just getting started. And the head of that department told me, he said, you know, I cannot support you. I cannot talk about any of this. I would be out of here. He would lose his job, which he valued more than stepping out and making a statement, because it's kind of like there's a whole line of firing people with a firing squad standing there pointed at them, and you're going to step out and say, I disagree, and boom, 20 people shoot you. You know, it's a professional suicide to do something. What I did at Cornell was professional suicide in a sense, and that's what happened. I was tossed out of there. But my audience, my classroom today is much, much bigger than if I would have stayed there. But I realized that the corruption in the educational system and in the science system, but this all started with Carl Sagan. And the reason Carl Sagan got the Cosmos series was because they had to bury Velikovsky. Velikovsky was selling in, his book was a worldwide bestseller, week after week on the New York Times bestseller list. It almost took down Doubleday Publishing Company. You know, the Velikovsky story is amazing. So they had to take that idea and bury it so deep that it would never, ever come out again. And so that's what Carl Sagan did. And that's why he got the Cosmos series, because he led...
Oh, that was his reward then, Jim. That was kind of a reward for doing this job on Velikovsky.
Right. He got the David Duncan Chair of Astronomy position at Cornell University, which is a seat that is probably as close to God in the eyes of university science as you can get. And so, and he did the Cosmos series, but he led the American Association for the Advancement of Science march against Velikovsky, where he gathered all of these so-called experts in geology and, you know, every other field, evolutionary biology, Stephen Jay Gould, who later stole Velikovsky's idea of radical change in evolution to account for the actual data. And Gould got a posthumous award for his so-called discovery, but he basically lifted it from Velikovsky, the guy that he had a hand in burying. So that's the...
Oh, I was not aware of that. That history with Gould, some of his work I admire very much, but I didn't know that.
Yeah. His idea of radical change and evolution is Velikovsky's, verbatim. And he got a big prize for that, like I say, posthumously, but he did. And that's what they have to do. They had to take Velikovsky, and then they can point at Velikovsky and say, oh, he's just a nutcase. And everybody has to repeat that like a mantra. And in which case, if you're in academia, you cannot bring up Velikovsky's name other than jokingly. But the reality is that academicians have not even read Velikovsky's work. They depend on Sagan, who didn't read it either.
And Sagan was wrong about the cratering of Venus. He thought, as you pointed out, one of the arguments that Sagan raised to defeat or destroy Velikovsky was that there were craters on Venus, but we know those are not craters. Those are actually volcanoes. So
they're active
the
volcanoes,
whole surface though. The whole surface is volcanic.
Right. So yeah, if you look through Sagan's work, he has so much wrong in there. It's unbelievable, but that doesn't matter because, like I say, that's the religion. He posted the religious outline of science, and everybody has to follow that. So that's why we are where we are at today.
Well, fortunately, Jim, I don't have a teaching position to lose. There's nothing they can do to me. I'm free to just do the research and let the chips fall, you know?
Right, right.
Well, it's a good place to be. I'm really fortunate.
Right, right. You're dealing with a big system, the textbook companies, the universities, you know, national science, the reputation of NASA, and there's a lot more going on in the background, because what I've learned, too, is that when the CIA took over NASA, they had always been kind of in control, even back into the Apollo days, etc. But they really took it over in 1991, and that's a whole long story in itself. But there's a lot more going on to keep the public in the dark about outer space than just this story. This is just one, one issue on the side. This is one of the things that points to the same issue, that large objects can come by. And the whole disinformation program regarding Planet X was dealing with that, to try and make it a Looney Tune topic, and so to bury that. That was a long-term CIA disinformation program with crazy lady talks to aliens. I'm not going to go into all of that, but the idea is that those are the things that they can then point to, and nobody in their right mind in science is going to ever go down that road, because this idea of tenure, I want to dispel that. Believe me, lots of people with tenure can be bounced in a moment's notice. They can find other ways to get rid of people. But tenure is good as long as you stay there and stay in line.
Yeah. So that's, yeah. Well, I feel very fortunate to now be a part of that system. So there's nothing they can do to me, really. I'm free to print what I discover, what the research shows.
Right, exactly. So back to where we're going with this. Let's take a minute, and I think we're running out of time here. But first of all, this is the first of many interviews, but on this topic. But where are we going from here?
Well, I didn't get a chance to get into it earlier. We brushed up against it. One of the data sets that I'm going to be exploring is the ocean core sediment studies. So we have thousands of ocean cores on record now. The Lamont Doherty Institute in New York, they also do seismic work. They have a very huge library back in the 70s, they already had like 5,000 ocean cores. So I ran into a problem with the mollusk studies, because we don't have that many well-preserved faunal beds. In other words, we have a lack of data. So I was not able to follow that as far as I wanted to, but I'm going to be taking a short break here of going camping. When I come back, I'm going to start hitting it again. And what I'm going to be delving into is these ocean cores, because I believe that if we look at the meridian of maximum displacement that we've drawn here on the map, this great circle, and we just look at the ocean cores in relation to that line, that great circle, it's going to confirm the change in the change in the ocean water temperature, which is critical for all of these ocean-dwelling species, these krill, they call it, these little radiolarians. And I'm not versed enough in this yet to talk about it in a lot of detail, but they are very temperature sensitive, just like the mollusks. And so when the crust moves, you're going to have the ocean temperature changing. And these critters are going to be moving to change. They're going to change, move back to their preferred habitat. And this is going to be reflected in the sediment, the cores, because this material gradually builds up on the floor of the ocean. And it's a very good record. It's a very accurate record if you know how to read it. And we've got enough experience now with these cores that I think we can do that. But the thing is that the scientists looking at this who have been studying these cores they have not been looking for this particular item. They haven't been looking at this. They've been looking at other things.
Right. Well, that's the issue with a lot of this. They're not allowed to. They're not, you know, they're not looking because by design. Mm-hmm. And if any of them ever had a fleeting thought about doing this, it probably wouldn't last long till they got to their first advisor, who would tell them, just don't go there. Go back and do what you were doing before. So anyway, yeah, there's a lot to be a lot yet to be done. And but having, like you say, the direction that the North Pole moved also tells you the direction of the impulse that came along with it. And that's very important. That's the direction.
Well, let me ask you, Jim, just follow up question on that, because I've been thinking about this and wondering, can you identify the direction? I mean, would you be able to reconstruct that event and determine what direction the comet was going, you know, or would you have to go back in time and try to place the Earth back in its orbit at that particular time? I mean, is there any way you could reconstruct it?
Actually not, and the reason is the Earth is spinning right now every 24 hours. It's spinning pretty fast. And when the comet came over the North Pole, or came under the South Pole, whichever one it did, it had one direction it could have been going, but in a couple hours, the Earth had already turned. That's how fast this happens. And so there's no way to pinpoint that moment in time. And one thing that Velikovsky pointed out too, which is very accurate, is that the rotational rate of the Earth changed. I talk about that in my Surviving Planet X Passage book, how the rotational rate of the Earth actually changes due to angular momentum, conservation of angular momentum between the crust and the interior. So, no, there's no way to reconstruct the timing of this, or the year, or the direction. There's no way of reconstructing that.
What about the idea that the line of force, the gravity wave that you talked about, would that change? Would that affect the tilt of the Earth, or is that a whole different set of equations? I don't have a clue on that.
It could affect it somewhat, but the majority of angular momentum in the Earth remains in the core that is not affected by the gravity wave, Take a partially hard-boiled egg. Take a raw egg, hard-boiled egg, and then a hard-boiled egg. If you take a hard-boiled egg and spin it, it keeps spinning. That's how you tell it's hard-boiled. If you take a soft hard-boiled egg, then just the outside, because the heat's coming in from the outside, just the outer part is solid. So take that and spin it, and what happens, let's say you take that and spin it, and then you try and change the surface of the egg, the inside keeps spinning in the same direction, and that's where the majority of angular momentum is kept. And so the outside does change, then what happens after the object passes by, the outside is, due to friction, catches up with the inner part, and then the whole thing starts spinning again. So that's why you get a change in the number of hours in a day. You probably get a change in the orbit. You get a change in the number of days in the year. So you have orbital changes and the polar direction changes. The actual rotational polar direction will probably change a little. So all of these things are happening, not to mention that the magnetic pole is dragged along with the physical pole, because that's up at the surface. And that's why the old magnetic North Pole has been wandering from Baffin Island slowly up to where the current North Pole is. It's trying to get back to there, and you can trace it back. And actually, if you could trace it back to where Baffin Island is, the old North Pole, it comes out to somewhere in the past 10,000 years when it was there. So all of these things add up. There's a lot of factors that add up from the physical point of view. But there again, I've been studying this for a long time from the physical point of view, and it's a really hard nut to crack. But it's very much there. getting real solid.
Do we have a record, Jim? Do we have a record of the change in the magnetic pole going back that far, or how can we? How far back can we?
No, we don't. But there's other ways of telling, because the magnetic field is locked into the iron beds and things like that that existed previously. And so, you know, those are studies that I'd like to do. I wish I had about 20 grad students that could be running around doing these kinds of studies. And, you know, you're going to get to the point where you're like that, too. Gee, I wish I had about 20 grad students. You could pick a topic and turn them loose in that direction and come back and then, okay, plot out the data. We're doing this kind of by ourselves, so... that's the thing. There's a lot to be done, but like I said, nobody's been allowed to pursue this avenue, because academia is, you know, they're all going to be lose their tenure if they even sniff in this direction.
Well, even people like Professor Schock, you know, the geologist who is now dating the Sphinx to a much older time than the Egyptologists wanted, he is very dismissive of Hapgood's work, you know, and I'm going to be taking him on in my project.
Right.
On this issue anyway.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because people have they've hung their hat on the wrong, you know, hat rack. And now you got to deal with people that have a vested interest in things that couldn't possibly be true, but they're, you know, have some university position, etc. You know, be that as it may, we're just going to have to move forward. And the thing is, also, we're presenting this to the public. We're not going through peer-reviewed journals and things like that, which would snuff this out in a New York second.
Right, and I could breathe heave another sigh of relief that I'm not part of that system.
Right, exactly. That's a very closed system, and, yeah, it's one that you're not going to succeed in. But... at any rate, well, Mark, we're going to have to cut this one off here, but we will revisit this. My Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet talks about the physical processes of pole shifts. Go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and right at the very top is a link to a subpage which I created, which has one of Mark's initial articles there. So you can read some more about the idea of the concept of... Now, Mark, give us that term again, crustal displacement, right?
Crustal displacement, yes.
Instead of pole shift. It's a new term we're going to pick up here because of the unfortunate demise of the English language with, you know, so crustal displacement, a much better term than pole shift, although they mean the same thing. So thanks a lot, Mark. We'll talk to you again soon, talk to you offline, and... well, we'll revisit this again in the near future. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.